And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Coming up now is EcoLogic with Ken Gale, so stay tuned. If you know anyone who should be hearing an environmental show the way WBAI does it, they don't live in the area, they can hear all of it as it happens by going to WBAI.org.
Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth? Share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom, peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, then tell me where we gonna plant our seeds.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. This is Ken Gale for EcoLogic, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And this show is about money, about your money, the money you pay in taxes that's given away to corporations that pollute. And luckily, there are organizations that have banded together to try to slow that down a little bit. And Autumn, welcome back to EcoLogic.
Thanks, Ken. Glad to be here.
And Ben, welcome to EcoLogic for the first time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And so the Green Scissors Report, you've been doing it for 16 years. What is it?
So the Green Scissors Report, the campaign is basically the idea is to bring our group, which is a budget group, and bring that sort of taxpayer's perspective with conservation partners, Friends of the Earth, who is the lead and group and founder of Green Scissors, and talk about environmentally wasteful spending. So federal dollars, as you said, things that taxpayers are paying for that are harmful to the environment.
And who gets to see this report?
The report is aimed to educate the public, members of Congress. We think it's a great opportunity as Congress is talking about how to deal with budget deficits and where to make hard cuts, to make some cuts that are actually easy and that make sense and that make sense across a wide political spectrum.
Give us a few examples.
So, you know, one example that you were talking about just in the news section was loan guarantees for dirty energies, renewable loan guarantees that everyone hears about through Solyndra. Actually, that program is primarily going to dirty energy sources like nuclear power, like coal plants, potentially a liquid coal plant in Wyoming. It's a program that is necessary for the rebirth of the nuclear industry here in Washington, here in the U.S., and it's just a program that makes no sense. Another area that you know people haven't really been talking about as much is giveaways of our public lands. We give away mineral rights for free to giant, massive corporations so that they can extract precious metals like gold and silver with no return to the taxpayers.
Just give them away. To what industries?
So, again, gold and silver extraction, so giant mining corporations like Rio
right.
Tinto.
Rio Tinto and Barrick, and so they're huge. I mean, part of the problem is that we have laws governing some of our resources that are centuries old, and so for the instance of mining that Ben is talking about, our mining practices are governed by a law that passed in 1872. I mean, this is clearly the mining industry has changed since 1872, and that's the problem. I mean, a lot of people don't even know these things are on the books, and that's how we're operating our government and how we're patrolling our resources here. I mean, we gold prices are sky high, and yet taxpayers are getting no benefit while on our federal lands are being mined for all of these resources, and the return isn't there. As Ben mentioned, we're losing billions of dollars. And then, in many cases, they're leaving mines in a terrible state, and taxpayers, again, have to come and pay for cleanup and take care of mitigation. And so we're not only losing because we're giving these resources away, we're paying for cleanup. I mean, there's so many liabilities associated with mining, and these are the kinds of things that we really try to bring out in the Green Scissors Report and let people know this is happening and encourage and urge for reform.
And I should mention that you can see the Green Scissors Report for yourself online by going to greenscissors.com. And you can see the entire report. You can see past reports. They've been doing this a long time, and there's a lot of great information. And I mean, the table of contents, there's so many different issues that you're covering. Conventional fossil fuels, nuclear energy, alternative energy, commodity crops, market access programs for agriculture, crop insurance, air service in the transportation sector, timber subsidies, grazing, livestock, national flood insurance, Army Corps of Engineers. There is so much to do. I guess let's talk about some of the partners that you're working with. Ben is from Friends of Earth, and Autumn is from Taxpayers for the Common Good?
Taxpayers for Common Sense.
Common Sense. And who are some of your other partners?
So the most current Green Scissors report is Green Scissors 2011. And on that report, we worked with Public Citizen, who is a consumer advocacy group founded by Ralph Nader, and most would say left-leaning. And then we're also working with the Heartland Institute, who many in my community, the environmental community, as staunch climate deniers, so they are staunch climate deniers, and who are very difficult partners for us normally. And that's what the great thing about the Green Scissors Report really is that four groups that have really diverse missions, have really fundamentally different beliefs in the role of government, can come together and say, these are things that don't make sense to any of us. And so when you go into offices, they have to take notice because of the strange bedfellows coalition that we've put together.
Yeah, the Heartland Institute was quite a surprise to me. And what did they contribute to this report? I have to admit to being very curious as to their role in it.
So, I mean, I think insurance issues were a big part of their concerns, their primary concerns. But all of these things, I mean, it's a consensus document. So really, everything in here they have read, endorsed, signed on to, and agree with. So we have to all, I mean, it's a very difficult process on what's included. And I mean, the perspectives and sort of how these are environmentally harmful and other things, I mean, clearly some of these issues are going to be of concern to Friends of the Earth for different reasons than they may be for Heartland Institute. But the idea that we could get both of them at the table and talk about this and then come up with the consensus. And I think, again, makes it really powerful, as Ben was saying, and really does, especially with a target audience on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, where everything is so polarized, you can really walk into any office, any member of Congress's office with this, and they have to take it seriously, and they have to look at it. And that's something that is unique these days in Washington.
I think Autumn pointed
out... an understatement.
I know.
And Autumn pointed out something that's really important. Take nuclear power as an example. Friends of the Earth is rabidly anti-nuclear. We think that Fukushima was just an illustration of the disaster that nuclear power is, and then all of the reasons why we shouldn't do it. The Heartland Institute is actually strongly pro-nuclear power, and think that nuclear reactors make a lot of sense, and they're unabashedly so, and they'll say so. But at the same time, they don't think it's the role of government to be funding nuclear power, to be subsidizing it, and they think that if the market's going to if the industry is going to succeed, they should be succeeding in the market on their own merits. And so they think that we should eliminate subsidies for nuclear reactors, even though they think we should be building more reactors. And so we approach it from a totally different angle, but at the same time we get to the same place. And that's what's great about the Green Scissors report.
Wow, it's almost amazing, especially in the current climate. What kind of reaction do you get from Congress people or their staff when they see such disparate groups working together like this?
It's actually incredibly successful. I think that the corn ethanol debate that took place last year is a great illustration of how powerful coalitions like this can be. Just a little bit over a year ago, we had a $6 billion tax per year tax credit for corn ethanol, which corn ethanol is polluting for the environment. It potentially increases food prices and creates poverty and hunger in the third world. It has all kinds of horrible air and water and greenhouse gas emission impacts, and we still are subsidizing. We still have a mandate, but we were giving it a tax credit, and it had been reauthorized over a year ago. We let that tax credit expire at the end of last year, and we had 73 senators vote to expire it early, have it expire early, less than a year after it had been extended for another year. And that was because we had a really diverse coalition that included groups like Friends of the Earth, like Taxpayers for Common Sense, like the Heartland Institute, working together on a shared and common goal.
They're doing a show like Ecologic. I'm constantly reporting about various things that different corporations or governments are doing to the environment, air, water, land, whatever. And it's really kind of nice to be able to do a show like this where there can be some unity and it can improve the life of everybody. And you know, when you talked about you had to reach consensus on everything, and you reached consensus on $380 billion worth of tax cuts. And I remember when I did a show on the Green Scissors Report about, 4 years ago, you had mentioned, Autumn, that, you know, you had to stop somewhere, and you stopped at $200 billion at that report. So how do you know where to stop, since you stopped at almost double?
Yeah, it is a challenge to come up with the cuts that we include. There are so many places that the federal government is involved, where you're talking about royalties and lost revenues and tax cuts, as you mentioned. And so we're really going through. We try to almost exclusively rely on government sources for the data, and we're pulling together these numbers and trying to come up with estimates. And it's very difficult because most of these programs are, and subsidies are buried, and people aren't aware of them, and we're trying to figure out, and then we have to sort of find out what they do and where the dollars are going. And so it's definitely challenging to dig this all up and come together on it. And one of the things that I think is really was really great about the report in 2011 was that we really wanted to try to put as much as we could into it. We had, of course, deadlines to meet to try to get anything out. We had to stop at some point. But to really offer this sort of laundry list of cuts. And the idea there is that even though we can't get probably one lawmaker to endorse all of the cuts, we can probably find a cut in here for every lawmaker. And so there's something in here that everyone is going to like and want to cut. And so that's, you know, that gives us ways to work on reform with many different types of folks on Capitol Hill for many different reasons. And that's really what we wanted to do, is just give people an idea of what's out there, you know, have people understand the kinds of subsidies that are going to many different corporations and industries that don't need them and that are harming the environment and causing additional costs down the road for taxpayers. And so that's I think one of the things that makes it, again, a really powerful document. When you walk into any office, they have definitely things in here I'm sure that they want to protect, and we know that. We hear that too. But there's always something that they can also point to and say, hey, I didn't know about that. That's a lot of money. I need to fund this priority in my district, or we need to take care of this deficit. And so we've just given them something right there, and we've pointed out to them where they can cut and really make a difference for the environment too.
Yeah, and I think an important thing is that this is not the all-inclusive list of wasteful anti-environmental spending that the government is doing right now. This is a good first step, and if we were to eliminate the programs and tax credits that are in the Green Scissors report, we would do, you know, a significant service to the environment and to the country. But there's more to be had, and the next year's report, 2012, or this year's report, I guess, will be even larger and broader. And the government continues to put in, you know, more and more harmful subsidies every year as well. And so it's a constant battle to move forward, and also to fight the desire to, or, you know, corporations' desire to continue to get more subsidies. And you know, a perfect example was 2 weeks ago there was a vote on something called the Natural Gas Act, which would have billions of dollars of subsidies for natural gas infrastructures for vehicles. So the idea would be that we're going to move away from oil by putting in massively expensive new infrastructure that would increase our use of natural gas from fracking and move us towards a dependence on yet another fossil fuel. So the fight never goes away.
But we did win, so it's good. Another coalition came together, you know, unique coalition of groups representing the left, the right, the moderates, and really urged opposition to it, and we were able to succeed. But the fight is far from over on that piece of legislation. There is massive support in the House and in the Senate for the Natural Gas Act, and it's something we're going to be working on all year. It's definitely one that many senators have gotten behind, and leadership, Senate leadership, is behind as well, and so that makes it a challenging fight.
And you're listening to EcoLogic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. My guests today are Autumn Hanna from Taxpayers for Common Sense and Ben Schreiber from Friends of Earth, and we're talking about the Green Scissors Report. So we'll be talking about taxpayer cuts because we don't want to be polluting the environment and pay for it at the same time on both directions. We pay for it in our own health problems. And is that something you can analyze at all, is how pollution damages our health? You know, the cancer increases from nuclear power and asthma from coal plants and things like that.
So, you know, there are plenty of analyses on the costs, the human costs to pollution, and those are out there. But really, this report focuses just on the taxpayer costs, the direct costs that people are paying out of their pocketbook for these programs. And so while, you know, we could go into that, we really haven't. But Friends of the Earth is a strong supporter of, for instance, a carbon tax, because we do think that polluters should pay for their pollution and that there is a need to put a price on carbon if we're going to have any realistic chance of avoiding the worst impacts of global warming. But, you know, this report is much more narrowly focused.
And so let's go through some of the other commodity crops. What does that mean? That's in your table of contents here.
So commodity crops are basically that a majority of our subsidies are going to just a handful of crops, commodity crops that are run by corporate farms. So these subsidies are ones, instead of, a lot of times we think of agriculture and we think of small family farms, but really our subsidies that taxpayers are paying for are going to the mega farms that are growing cotton, corn, rice, and soybeans. This is major agribusiness. This is not the family farm. And again, as we sort of brought up with the hard rock mining and 1872 mining law, I mean, these are programs that were started decades ago and are just outdated, do not make sense for the way our agriculture system works now, and we provide these subsidies to these major agribusinesses, and it's policies that need major reform.
Yeah, and from Friends of the Earth's perspective, I mean, these are payments that are going to the largest, most industrialized farmers that actually have the worst practices, and it continues to incentivize a farming system that is broken. It continues to incentivize monocultures. It actually is a massive subsidy for biofuels. It incentivizes pesticide use. All of the horrible farming practices that are poisoning our environment, our water, and our air.
And it makes the small farmer almost give up farming because they can't compete. You know, they have lower expenses because they don't spend the money, but since the agribusiness expenses are covered by taxpayer subsidies, they can't compete.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, from our point of view, this is just a first step in fundamentally reforming the agricultural system that we have here in the United States so that we can actually have the type of practices that we need to have a sustainable agricultural system.
Right, and we have a farm bill debate is happening now. I mean, and this is a time that, you know, our organization is spending a lot of time and resources really trying to be in there advocating for reform and making sure that people understand the flaws of our agricultural subsidy system. I mean, what taxpayers are losing and giving now to these major agribusinesses that don't make sense anymore. And so we have that opportunity now with the farm bill debate happening, and that's something that we hope many groups will take up with us. And we are, again, trying to really build a strong coalition, just like with these other issues, of diverse constituencies to bring that message to Capitol Hill to make sure that we get some of these reforms in the Farm Bill and it's not just business as usual.
Yeah, I know there's a cliche that people who live in cities like New York don't understand where food comes from, but we have green markets all over the city and small produce sellers all over the city. So we certainly do know where food comes from. So issues like this are very relevant to New Yorkers. And what's crop insurance? I see that as a subject here.
Yeah, crop insurance is actually the giant, it's basically the biggest subsidy for crops right now. And there's going to be and has been a fight over commodity crop payments, and that's an ongoing fight. But what the farm industry wants more than anything else is crop insurance. And that's basically government-subsidized insurance so that they get payouts in the case of bad yields or bad harvests. So rather than going on to the private market to get that insurance and having to pay the fee, we actually, the government subsidizes it and pays a significant portion of that fee, and it's billions of dollars every year. We also pay insurance fees for things like flood insurance and nuclear reactors through Price Anderson. So government subsidized insurance is a massive subsidy.
Yeah, it's one that's often not discussed, and I don't think people realize what taxpayers are paying, again, providing this lucrative insurance programs. And if you think about the nuclear industry, I mean, without Price Anderson, it's pretty well thought that or agreed to that we would not even have the nuclear industry. I mean, I think just a few weeks ago, Senator Sanders was questioning Secretary Chu, the Department of Energy secretary, on the same issue, and he agreed with the senator that without the lucrative insurance program through Price Anderson, we wouldn't even have the nuclear industry today. I mean, again, this is taxpayers taking on the risk, and for any nuclear accident, we carry the majority of liability. And so that's an enormous subsidy that people aren't talking about.
And then the kicker, too, is that the Farm Bureau actually makes money off of crop insurance. because they're the ones that are providing crop insurance.
Who's the Farm Bureau?
The lobby group for big agro farmers. So not only does it help the biggest, largest farmers, but it also then helps their lobby industry as well, their lobby arm as well.
So many of these programs do.
And, you know, you've used the term loan guarantee several times, and that sounds almost benign. Could you give a little detail about exactly what a loan guarantee is and why it's so bad for taxpayers?
Yeah, so first of all, the term loan guarantee is actually often a misnomer. For the nuclear loan guarantees, the Title 17 loan guarantees, most of them are actually direct loans that are coming out of the federal treasury, but members of Congress have used the term loan guarantee because that was the way that the program was originally meant to function. But what a loan guarantee really is crony capitalism at its best. The taxpayers insure a loan from a private bank. We guarantee a significant portion of it. In the case of the program that we're talking about now, it's 80% of that loan. And if nothing goes wrong, well, that's all fine and good, and the private bank gets a return on their investment, and everyone's happy. But if the company that's taking out the loan defaults, then taxpayers step in and pay back the bank. So it's basically a preemptive bailout. It's a huge, huge risk for taxpayers. Could cost taxpayers tens of billions of dollars in the case of something like a nuclear reactor if the costs were to escalate and the plant weren't to be built.
I've heard loan guarantee as you know, when they want to explain it in a benign way, is that when a parent co-signs a loan for their child for a car. But it goes a little beyond that, doesn't it?
Well, so it just depends on the specific loan guarantee program. Uh-huh. But yes, I mean, that's the essence of a loan guarantee, is basically when the loan, when the recipient of a loan defaults, we've guaranteed it. So the nuclear industry, for instance, comes in and gets a loan from a private bank, but we guarantee it. So that bank is taking on no risk because they know they have the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury behind that loan that they've just given. So they're guaranteed that they're going to get their money. And that's the thing, that none of these industries can get loans. These projects can't get loans without taxpayers co-signing them or underwriting them. And that's the key here, is that we are saying, if this project is a risky investment, we're taking on all that risk, and we're going to take that burden on instead of that bank. And that, again, makes the prospect very lucrative for the lender. And that's really what this is about, projects that can't get their own financing. And in many cases, for good reason, like the economic risks associated with building a nuclear reactor.
And it still seems really benign to, you know, co-sign for a car. But to co-sign for a $7 or $10 billion nuclear reactor is a whole different proposition.
If the company decides they don't want to pay the loan, can they get away with that because the government will pay for them?
So, yes. I mean, if the project, if for whatever reason they decide to not pursue the project that they've taken the loan for and they've defaulted on it for whatever reason, then yes, that's right. They have... the repercussions for them are very minor because we've taken on 80% of that project cost with that loan. So that's been set up to 80% of the project. So they lose very little. They have very little to lose. And that's part of the problem with the loan guarantee program. I mean, we set it up so that this is enormous subsidy. And so projects that investors have very little to lose, and projects that aren't really economically justified move forward. And so you see some of these big clean coal, liquid coal, and nuclear reactors are the ones that this program is most lucrative for, because these are projects that can't even come close to getting their own private financing.
And then, I mean, going back to the car analogy, because I sort of like it, the truth of the matter is that that's a gift from the parents to the children, just in the same way that this is a giant gift from the federal government to giant multinational corporations or electric utilities. And, you know, it illustrates that it is a giant favor that's being done at taxpayer risk. And there's actually little to no return, just like there's no return for the parent that's co-signing the loan. The best that happens is that the kid can actually pay for their car. There's actually no return for the taxpayers either. You know, the absolute best that can happen is that the reactor, well, I don't know the best, but fiscally the best that can happen is that the reactor gets built. We're stuck with the waste, and we don't actually have to put out $6 or $8 billion for it. It's a lose-lose situation for the taxpayer.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons that we focus at Taxpayers for Common Sense on loan guarantees so much, in addition to what we're talking about, is because the way they reflect on the budget. I mean, we're really signing off on these loans that are for the Vogtle plant that you mentioned earlier. I mean, over $8 billion, but it doesn't score that way in the budget. So again, these are huge amounts of money.
It doesn't score that way in the budget. What does that mean?
Right. So basically, we're not counting for that. So if that loan defaults, we haven't budgeted for it at all. In fact, we budget for it at 1% of its cost, which that's not very good accounting if you ask us. And we really think that's a key problem with it, is that it looks like they're free. Like, you can just give out as many loan guarantees as you want to these mega projects, these nuclear reactors. And later on, we're going to be paying a huge price tag when these projects default. And because the economics aren't there, we think it's extremely likely that that's what we're going to see. I mean, we know that nuclear power is in economic dire straits right now, and it's not a good investment for taxpayers. We shouldn't be getting behind these reactors, and the long-term costs that with waste and other things that Ben was mentioning, I mean, even if you take the environmental side out of this, the fiscal side is the case against nuclear power is not there to be made.
And let's go on to another subject in the Green Scissors report. Essential air service. That's something that I think very few people know about, and how much money is being spent there.
So from Friends of the Earth's perspective, air service is actually is the most carbon-intensive way to travel. And we absolutely should not be subsidizing the construction of airports or flights or anything else. If we're going to spend our scarce transportation dollars, just like we shouldn't be building new highways for cars, we should be using that money on things like high-speed rail, on things like public transportation that actually reduce greenhouse gases and reduce environmental harm. And I'll let Autumn talk about the taxpayer side of that program in particular.
Right. So, I mean, it's just, again, we're subsidizing these airports. We just think it's a hugely wasteful subsidy. And the flights and the airports that they're subsidizing just aren't just economically justified in any way.
What airports are you talking about?
So we give examples in the report. One of the examples we give is a 50-minute flight from Lebanon, New Hampshire to Boston gets a subsidy of $287 per passenger, when it's really just an over an hour drive to the Boston airport. So, I mean, that is an enormous subsidy that's going to air travel that's unnecessary, when these folks could be flying out of Boston if that was necessary air travel, and it's, you know, an hour drive. And again, so you're looking at a huge taxpayer cost that we are opposed to and have been for a long time, and Friends of the Earth is, you know, going to raise the environmental consequences of that as well. So this is a cut which shows the sort of the way that our groups can work together and really highlight some of these extremely wasteful things that taxpayers are paying for that also carry, you know, environmental consequences.
There's a Boeing aviation physicist I love to quote, because he describes the takeoff of a 747 as like taking the entire contents of a gas station and setting it on fire and throwing it through the air.
Yeah, and you're doing it for literally a 50-minute drive. You're in the air for like 10 minutes. You take off,
right.
You hover, and then you land.
So what's the justification for putting that amount of money into that amount of pollution?
There's no way to justify it. This is really just, you know, congressional pork, and that's why programs like these are particularly hard to get rid of, because they're massive subsidies that members of Congress can take home to their constituents and wave around at press conferences.
Right. I mean, I think, again, really highlighting the issue that some of these things may have made sense when they were enacted, but just haven't been revisited, haven't been reformed, And in many cases, we don't think they ever made sense. But at least they may have made better sense. I mean, when you think about things like the oil and gas industry, and you think about how we give them royalty relief today when oil prices are sky high, you may think that maybe in 1995, when we were thinking about that, in 1996, when we were passing this legislation, oil prices were $20 a barrel and or less. And it, you might have been thinking, well, that maybe makes sense. But now, it absolutely ridiculous that we still have these policies in place that we're still giving royalty relief. And the same is true for mining and these airport services. I mean, so a lot of these are things that some much older than others have been on the books, but are all just don't make any economic sense right now.
And how many of these little airports around the country are there that are getting all this money? I would think it was only rich people who were using those airports in the first place, which I guess is why.
Right. I don't believe I have a total number of airports, but it's definitely a hefty subsidy. So I don't think it's that many. I don't know if Ben, you.
I don't know. I'd have to look, but there are definitely tens of them at least. And you know, the one that was closest to me is up in Frederick.
Well, and what we're looking at for just over 5 years in our Green Scissors numbers is over $800 million in subsidies to these airports. So it's real money that can be saved here. And it's just, again, a very wasteful policy that doesn't make any sense, that came about in the late 1970s and was really folks being concerned about where airlines were going to go and routes they were going to take and if small airports would get service. But in many cases, these small airports just may not be necessary in most cases. So,
and like many of the subsidies, this was actually meant to be temporary.
Yes.
And has become a permanent fixture these days. And I think that's one of a common theme of a lot of these things, is that you give a subsidy, you say it's going to be temporary, and that subsidy stays on the books for decades or longer. And you know, the volumetric ethanol excise tax credit, the tax credit for ethanol, was a perfect example. I mean, it took us 30 years to stop subsidizing ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we're still subsidizing oil and gas. I mean, that's another thing. You say these are startup industries that when they're just getting going. We passed them in 1916, 1918, and we keep them on the books. Or we wanted to, the mining law, we wanted to develop the West. Isn't that a funny thing to think of now? And so we passed the 1872 mining law so that those going out there with their pick and axe can look for gold. And we still use that to govern our mining policies today.
Yeah, it is funny to think of the oil and gas industry as startup industries, having laws to protect them. And I am talking to Autumn Hanna and Ben Schreiber, who are two of the primary authors of the Green Scissors Report. Autumn is from Taxpayers for Common Sense, and Ben is from Friends of Earth. And you can read the Green Scissors Report on greenscissors.com and get details on what we're talking about. It's quite a few pages to be reading, so if there's no way we can cover every bit of detail. And also on that webpage, you can get past reports and see things. And we are running out of time, and we haven't talked about your successes. You've been doing the Green Scissors Report for 16 years, is it?
Yes, we've been doing it for 16 years.
And so has it had any positive results?
Yeah, so we already talked about, you know, corn ethanol, which was our big success last year, and which we're, you know, really proud of. But we've also had a fair number of successes throughout the years as well. We've stopped things like highways that were particularly egregious. We've reduced some of the scope of some of the oil and gas credits. One of the things that we focused on was the size of the royalties that we're getting for our oil and gas resources offshore, and actually President Bush increased royalty rates for offshore drilling, and President Obama is actually talking about increasing royalty rates for onshore drilling. So we have had a tangible impact, and we have, you know, some concrete success stories that we're very proud of.
How many billions of dollars has the Green Scissors Report saved so far?
The latest calculation that we had is $36 billion.
$36 billion with a B.
With a B. But that's definitely old because we haven't included the corn ethanol piece in there. So it'll be higher than that.
That's something to be really proud of.
Yeah, I mean,
you've helped every American.
Right. I think we're very proud of our successes. I think that we really understand. I mean, we all know that the challenges we face, and I think a lot of times our victories are not the full program or what we get, but we're moving in the right direction. And I think that's what we're going to, you know, we just continue to chip away at these things. And that's one of the things, I mean, we talked about loan guarantees. The program, we think, is a huge problem still and has still a lot of money in it, but we've stopped $50 billion expansion on that program numerous times. In the stimulus, for example, they were going for $50 billion in new nuclear loan guarantees added on to the $18 billion that we have now. So, I mean, these are victories that, although we haven't eliminated the program, we have made huge success. And I think that's the kinds of things where you just feel like you're chipping away at these harmful programs. And it takes a lot of work because most people don't even know that these kinds of subsidies are happening.
And the difficulty is also a testament to just how powerful corporations are here in Washington, D.C. You know, none of these subsidies get on the books by accident. They're all there because some corporate special interest wanted them. And so it's very hard to get them repealed. And so it's a constant fight.
All right. And one thing I should mention, because I think it a lot of people will be confused about it. Hybrid car tax credit.
Yeah, so let's talk about the that was one that was misconstrued by a lot of people. The hybrid car tax credit, which has now actually expired, the way that it worked was that it was capped at the number of hybrid cars per manufacturer. And so Toyota and Honda came out with the first hybrids, and those hybrids were actually the hybrids that got the most miles per gallon.
Right.
Things like the Prius were wildly successful, and the tax credit was an important part of that. But then what happened was those cars were no longer eligible for the tax credit because Toyota and Honda had actually sold their allocation of cars that received the tax credit. And so we were left with other manufacturers who were primarily building SUVs, hybrid SUVs. And so instead of getting a tax credit for a fuel economical, either a small car or a hybrid, you would get the tax credit for a large SUV hybrid that oftentimes actually didn't have better gas mileage or significantly better gas mileage than a similar hybrid because the added horsepower was, the added economy was actually going to increasing the horsepower, not to increasing gasoline efficiency. And so we were left with basically either specialty cars or some of the least efficient hybrid cars getting this tax credit.
Not all hybrids are built the same.
Definitely not all hybrids are built the same. You know, Friends of the Earth would definitely be in support of an across-the-board hybrid tax credit, or even better, a tax credit that went for the most efficient vehicles independent of technology. But the hybrid tax credit was broken in its last years and could actually incentivize you to buy, you know, if you wanted a hybrid vehicle, could incentivize you to buy a gas-guzzling hybrid as opposed to a Prius or one that was more efficient because you were getting a significant rebate from the government.
And what can our listeners do to help get some of the items on the Green Scissors Report passed?
So I think one of the most important thing that folks can do, and Ben and I often talk about this in conferences and with other folks who are in D.C., visiting with their members of Congress, is to really take the report. You know, you can see it on our website. Point your lawmaker to it. You can look at the issues that are relevant for your area in particular. You can talk about the whole report. You can just really bring it to your lawmaker's attention. Again, as I said earlier, there's really something for every lawmaker in here to focus on whatever their priorities are. There's going to be some cuts in here that they can take a leadership role on. And so that's a really important thing for folks to do. It's obviously so important for them to hear it from their own constituents that they're concerned with these issues. And I think, you know, pointing them to the report and the numbers and the documentation that we have in there, I think is really helpful for those members to see and hear it, not just from us, the report authors, but also from their own constituents.
So in other words, read the report and whatever strikes your fancy, bring that up to your senator and your congressperson.
You can bring up the specific issues. You can bring up the whole concept. And because we have lawmakers, we have a Green Scissors Caucus in the House.
Caucus in the House?
Yes, so this is a group of lawmakers. It was led by Congressman Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, and Congressman Steve Chabot, a Republican from Ohio. Those were the former co-chairs. There were dozens of members involved in that. We have, at the release of this 2011 report, we had lawmakers from both parties. We really emphasize the bipartisanship of this, and we really think it's important to bring up the concept of just getting behind green scissors and looking at environmentally harmful spending, agreeing to that principle, and coming together to do work on various issues. And so that's the nice thing. I mean, not every member in that caucus worked on every issue, but it offered a forum to talk about it and bring things up. And I think you can look at the VTEC success. That was one. The corn ethanol tax credit was one of the big targets of Green Scissors. Many of the lawmakers who are champions of Green Scissors were also champions of that reform. And that's something I think we can really count as a Green Scissors victory, and that bipartisan spirit carried through in that victory.
And each item of the Green Scissors report has a website you can go to get more information. So if you're a student who wants to know more, there's something for you. If you talk to a congressman who seems ignorant about all this, you can get more information or give them more information. So there's a lot of ways of using the Green Scissors report. And I'm so glad it exists, because people talk about, they know that there's this pork, and they know that there's these giveaways and subsidies, and they don't know where they are and where. And you guys have been digging for years and can identify them for us. So it's a great organizing tool for any environmental group anywhere in the United States, and I guess outside the U.S. as well.
Right. And we really try to work with local folks. I mean, with this report, we did an event in Illinois, for example, where there's a clean coal plant that they're trying to build called Futuregen, and it's received $1 billion in federal subsidies. It's one that we've highlighted in the report for years, and it's something that we worked with local farmers in the area who were concerned about the plant's footprint, the plant's sequestration site, and what it was going to have an effect on their small farms and their small communities. And we did events together. We had lots of local coverage. Sort of the partnership there is also really important. So in addition to our work with our national groups in writing the report, really partnering with local citizens on issues that are national subsidies but have local importance and relevance, I mean, that's something that is, I think, a really important part of what Green Scissors can do as well.
And again, greenscissors.com, and my guests have been Autumn Hanna, Taxpayers for Common Sense, and Ben Schreiber, Friends of the Earth. And you can get a lot of different ways of looking at these issues. But most of all, our taxpayer money should not be going to polluting the air and polluting the water and polluting the earth. It's ridiculous, and it should seem as silly as it obviously is, but when there's money involved, people can rationalize anything. They can rationalize murder. They can rationalize slow murder. They can rationalize anything, and that's what's going on. And it's really great that it's bipartisan. You've got a very left-wing group, a very right-wing group involved in this, and it shows that, you know, we all breathe air and we all drink water and we all need it to be clean. And that's something that goes beyond ideological aspects of anyone's life. So thank you for the Green Scissors Report. And I will continue to recommend it to my listeners and to anybody I speak with probably for years to come, I hope.
Thanks for having us.
Definitely. Thanks.
And actually, I hope I don't have to recommend it for years to come, because everything will be taken care of.
Right.
Don't worry. There's more we'll identify then.
Well, hopefully there won't be any more identified, because they will finally wise up. But thanks a lot. And I'm Ken Gale, and this is Ecologic here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. The movers and shakers of Wall Street have been a lot better at identifying problems they would have with the environmental movement than the environmental movement has been at identifying problems with Wall Street. Just an observation. Regular listeners know that I'm a renewable energy advocate and activist, and I know that solar powers on your home are cool and they raise your property values, but I want to point out that for a fraction of the price of solar panels, you can make your home save more energy than the solar panels would have provided. Most solar panel installers have people who will do this for you, and if you still want the solar panels, you won't need as large an array, and that saves money too. The Disrupt Dirty Power event at the United Nations two Saturdays ago turned out to be interesting, educational, energizing, and fun. I highly recommend you check out the video at www.disruptdirtypower.org. You may remember some of the organizers of that event on the show 2 weeks ago. Disruptdirtypower.org. Check out the video. And sometimes a news item is just right for the show I read it on, like this one from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You may have heard that they want to build two nuclear power plants in Georgia. They've already raised electricity rates to pay for them, but it's not enough. It's never enough. So they want $8.3 billion of taxpayer money, billion with a B. Congress is divided on whether to give them the money, partly due to Solyndra, ironically enough. So your call to your Congress rep is more influential than other, so give them a call. And this is from waterdefense.org. The EPA announced on March 15th that water from fracking sites in Pennsylvania was safe enough to drink. People knew better and demanded to see the test results, which the EPA would not release. Activists had to get the test results themselves, and it showed that the same toxic chemicals used in fracking were in the water. EPA was protecting frackers. And last week, a fracking compressor exploded in northeast Pennsylvania, just 30 miles south of Binghamton, New York. It took a long time to stop the resulting leak. The explosion has not slowed the fracking industry. The low price of methane hasn't slowed down that industry either, nor the fact that methane, which is marketed as natural gas, is a major greenhouse gas. And of course, they just deny the effects it has on drinking water. If you're hearing this show from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, or any other fracking state, contact your governor's office and urge him to ban the fracking method of gas extraction. And the main source of this next news item seems to be Reuters last Thursday. Several weeks ago, there was a pressure change at the French-owned Elgin North Sea platform, which is in relatively shallow water off the coast of Scotland. The rig has been leaking methane all that time and was evacuated March 25th. In the air, methane is a greenhouse gas worse than carbon dioxide. In seawater, it's a poison to plant and animal life, especially this gas, which has a high hydrogen sulfide content. There is fear of an explosion, and experts estimate that it will probably take 6 months to stop the leak. For more information, go to www.commondreams.org. Mainstream news seems to be ignoring this. Too similar to the BP Gulf disaster? It's commondreams.org. A lot of information there, and links to still more. And speaking of which, U.S. PERC sent out an email reporting that BP is using the cleanup of the blowout in the Gulf of Mexico 2 years ago to lower their taxes by $10 billion. BP isn't paying for the cleanup. Taxpayers are. And I had a chance to see the new bioluminescence exhibit at the Museum of Natural History and enjoyed it. I find animals that can create their own light to be fascinating, whether they're fireflies, plankton, or deep-sea fish, so I'm not the most objective reporter in this case. The museum is at 79th Street and Central Park West, with other entrances at 77th and 81st Streets. And the Occupy Wall Street Environmental Solidarity Working Group meets every Friday and Monday at the atrium at 60 Wall Street. They meet Fridays at 5:30 p.m. and Mondays at 6 p.m. Join them in planning various actions for all the weeks leading up to Earth Day. And in 2 weeks, on April 17th, one of my Celebration of Nature shows, this one with a birding community that I'm part of. All WBAI shows are available on archive.wbai.org, but the most recent direct links on the Ecologic webpage will get you there. That's the past guests page of www.comicbookradioshow.com/eco-logic.html. It's a link from the BAI website as well. March 20th was our Earth Month show. Corporations have co-opted Earth Day. They even got it moved 40 years ago. So to take it back, there was a month of activities leading up to the corporate Earth Day. My guests included four members of three different Occupy Wall Street environmentally oriented working groups. The March 6th show was a few days before the anniversary of the first day of the still ongoing disaster at the Fukushima nuclear plant. My guests were Minoru Nakamura, Takayo Lee, Keisuke Jino, and Chris Williams. The February 21st show was a two-hour show on hydraulic fracturing with Annie Wilson of the Sierra Club Atlantic Chapter, Deborah Goldberg of Earth Justice, Donna Stein of New York City Friends of Clearwater, Peter Rue of Occupy Wall Street's Environmental Working Group, and David Braun of United for Action. January 24th was Occupy Ecologic with five guests from the Occupy Wall Street Environmental and Sustainability Working Groups. And the following show will only be available for one more week. January 10th was How to Grow the Solar Energy Industry, which is crucial to reversing climate change and will create jobs and improve our health. Learn the difference between solar renewable energy credits and feed-in tariff. My guests were Anthony Pereira of All Power, Inc., John Siciliani of JFS Renewables, and Macon Mattson, co-founder and strategy and policy director for Lean Energy U.S. They are great at linking policy and business issues and cutting through the jargon. And you can donate to your favorite show, including this one, on the WBAI.org website. Scroll down a ways and you'll find online donations with a premium. You can get several episodes of Ecologic with a small donation. Show WBAI management that there is indeed an audience for environmental programs on WBAI and help shorten fund drives. And so I'll go out with Environmentalist by the Raging Grannies.
Oh, we're radical environmentalists. We're radical environmentalists. We like clean air and clean water, just like the farmer's daughter, 'cause we're radical environmentalists.
Yeehaw!
Oh, we like our veggies without pesticides, and hate beef and chicken fed with cows who die. We like fish without PCBs, and forests filled with old trees, 'cause we're radical environmentalists. We like autos that will cause us no pollution, and we think laws should provide a sane solution. We like lawns grown without weed and feed. We'll toss out every gene splice seed. We're radical environmentalists.
Yeehaw!
We want power that can always be renewed.
And how?
And we want to change consumer attitudes.
Yes, indeed.
Recycle all your glass and paper.